Welcome to the Future of Political Consulting by the AAPC, where we explore the evolving landscape of political consulting in a rapidly changing world. The AAPC is a bipartisan membership organization that represents professionals working in the political consulting industry. Our host today is Republican pollster Amanda Iovino. Amanda has more than 15 years of experience in polling, survey research, and campaign strategy. She will be leading the discussion with Larissa Martinez, founder and president of Women's Public Leadership Network and expert in policy and political strategy. Larissa has 2 decades of leadership experience on Capitol Hill and has served as a senior government relations professional at Washington, D.C.-based government relations firms and on the transition team for President Trump. Together, they will examine how gender influences voter perceptions, campaign strategies, and electoral outcomes. Amanda, take it away.
Thanks so much. And Larissa, it's great to be here talking with you about this. We've had a lot of discussions about this topic over the years, and it's nice to have it in public this time.
For sure.
So I think we'll kick it off and just talk about really the perception of women candidates and the standards that that women candidates are held to. So starting most broadly, do voters hold women candidates and male candidates to different standards?
Yes, is the short answer to that. I think that we know that that happens no matter what industry you're in, whether it be politics or business, just kind of life, there are different standards for men and women. I think for politics, it gets down kind of the next level, which is that there is a difference between what the voters see for both Republican and Democratic women as well, right? Those are different. And I think for a lot of women, this is where kind of the number one barrier lies when it comes to thinking about running for office or getting involved in politics in some way, shape, or form is like, am I going to be good enough? Can I put myself forward? What does authenticity look like? What are the different kind of things that voters are going to be expecting of me as a candidate? And, you know, one of the things we hear a lot is about how women need to be likable. Something that to me is always kind of interesting when you unpack that is, you know, public officials should be likable no matter what, because they're trying to put themselves forward as representatives of constituents. They need to go and talk to people. They need to relate to the community. I think the difference is that the definition for likability is different for men and women. And that getting into the weeds of what does that entail is the devil is kind of in the details when it comes to women candidates. So the standards are different, but I don't think that they are necessarily unreachable or unattainable. You just kind of have to know going in with eyes wide open of what the voters are going to be expecting. But a lot of people, if you are someone who is involved in your community and you reflect that community, there are ways, of course, to be trained and have your professional skills help develop some of that confidence, that polish, helping to, you know, feel a little bit more professional when you put yourself out there. But a lot of the expectations are kind of already there. It's just a matter of getting yourself in a place where you feel authentic, confident, and trained so that you feel as though you can put yourself forward and meet those expectations and kind of have them taken off the board so that you can really start presenting your vision for the position that you're putting yourself forward for and what the different policy priorities you have for that position. But I know that you see a lot of this from a polling side when you're looking at the numbers. So I'd be curious, too, if you have anything additional to add.
Yeah, I think that is right on when it comes to the authenticity and kind of how women candidates show up and are perceived. The other piece of it, obviously, is the policy positions. And one of the things that we've seen in the data is when voters are looking at women candidates through lenses of certain issues, women candidates are trusted more. And when other issues are kind of top of mind, male candidates kind of get the more benefit of the doubt. And it's just based off of stereotypes. Namely, if it's a security-related election, frankly, like the one that we just had, voters are going to be more likely to believe that the man has experience in the issue or knowledge about the issue that the woman doesn't. But when the main topic is something like healthcare, women will get the advantage. And it is, you know, one of the issues in Republican primaries to getting women through is that Republican primary voters are often very security focused, whether it's immigration or national security. And that leads them to lean a little bit more towards trusting the male candidate on that issue, even before you get to the likability factor. But off of that, I mean, you've worked with bipartisan groups. Is there other differences that you've seen over the years between how Republicans approach the standards for women candidates versus Democrats?
Yeah, you know, it's an interesting question and an interesting thing that we've actually kind of delved into at WPLN and through some of the other work I've done is, you know, what is authenticity? What does it look like for not just Democratic or Republican women, but also regionally, and seeing what the differences are? I think one of the very kind of just first things I always come to is that is, hate to say it, a little bit more of a barrier, but we could also talk about why we also see fewer Republican women in office just generally than Democratic women. And some of it is because there is kind of this automatic base of support among women for women candidates on the Democratic side. Whereas the Republican side, we tend to see a little bit more of a pushback against this, the identity politic, which manifests into, I want to see that, I want the candidate to prove themselves to me rather than immediately feeling like, oh, well, if you're a woman and I'm a woman and you're running, I should support you because we don't have enough of you because, you know, there's the relatability piece of this. And so I think because of that, it adds a little bit of an extra layer. So to your point, if you have a Republican woman running in a primary against a man and economic and national security are top line issues, and you automatically have more Republicans looking toward the men as more credible or more secure that they can handle the issue more than a woman can. And then you add on top of it that she can't necessarily guarantee that women will support her just for being who she is, then you've made that a lot more difficult and challenging in that scenario. If you take the same scenario and put that to the Democrats, the issues are a little bit different and they do have a little bit more of a base with Democratic women, supporting Democratic women, in large part because for the past 40 years or more, they've assigned a specific policy position to that of the gender, right? So pro-choice women are kind of together, whereas on the Republican side, you see a lot of different variations depending on where a woman is with her principles and her policy positions and where she's running. So I think there is going to be that difference. You know, on the Republican side, you see generally a gravitation towards women that are a little bit more polished or professional, I should say, tend to be a little bit older. Whereas on the Democratic side, authenticity looks a little bit different because their audience is a little different. Not that they don't look professional, but professionalism can manifest in a little bit more relaxed way than what we see on the Democratic side or the Republican side. One of the examples I bring up is that I one time was sitting at a table talking to a Republican female candidate, and she saw her Democratic opponent come in and she was like totally disheveled. Her hair was wet. Like her clothes were not ironed. She was like, oh my gosh, I had to drop my kids off today. Like I'm running late. I'm just trying to get there. Like you could just tell it was like, oh my gosh. And she looked at me and she said, I could never get away with that in my election. Like I have to look like I'm like 100% put together no matter what. Like the background stuff of my life does not come into play. Whereas I think Democrats are a little bit more open to being able to see some of those vulnerabilities and see some of that day-to-day life reflect in your person. And I think that is a difference that you see. And again, neither one of those speaks to the credibility or the effectiveness of either one as a candidate or as a leader. That's not even the point at question. It's just straight up how people perceive the different sides.
Yeah. And I think, you know, one of the other factors that we haven't necessarily touched on quite yet is that how the media perceives the two and talks about the two sides and women candidates on either side of the aisle then impacts how voters view those candidates. You know, there's a lot of focus on like Hillary Clinton's pantsuits in 2016 and prior. You know, Nikki Haley talking about her heels was a very good thing in some circumstances and then a very bad thing in some others. And there's a lot of those different flashpoints. Obviously, Kamala had her own set of these. But how do you see the media kind of evolving, or have they evolved in how they talk about women candidates?
So I do see that the media tries to at least, I'm trying to think of the right way to say this without bashing those of the media that may be listening to this podcast, but I do think that the media over the years has done a better job of at least trying to search out those different perspectives and find these different leaders to highlight. I think the thing, though, that I see most prevalent is that majority of the time, if they're looking for a woman's perspective, especially an elected woman's perspective, they will default to a Democrat way more often than we see the Republican side. And if they find a Republican woman to speak to them on a particular issue, it's normally a certain brand of Republican that, or a certain kind of space in the spectrum that may not be reflective of the entire spectrum. I find there to be a lot more nuance and variety among women that run as Republicans than sometimes on the left. And so when you're looking to find someone to speak on behalf of Republicans, you do have to do a little bit more work, because it does matter what their brand is, what position they hold, what their influence is. I mean, that's across the board. But if you're only going to get one or two Republicans to, let's say, speak on a story or to speak on something, and then you're going to do the same for Democrats, you're just going to have, we'll see more Democrats being brought in to provide that example than on the Republican side. I also find that It's the obvious quote unquote issues, to your point, like healthcare or education or these, or any policies relating to families, that tends to be where you see mostly women like sought after for their opinion or for kind of what policies they're interested in, instead of seeing women as just leaders blanketly, so that they can speak on any number of issues. It doesn't have to just be that their credibility is for those pieces. And then, of course, when you get to super high levels and you start to see the media coming into play when it comes to commenting on women as candidates on the campaign trail, I do feel like they tend to give a little bit more press or paper time to airtime to men more so. I think there's kind of a almost inherent bias that the men are seen as front runners or like potentially like very credible challengers. Whereas on the women, I think you kind of see them sometimes more as like a footnote, as like, oh yeah, this woman got in. Thank you. You know, like they're not necessarily brought in at that same level initially. They kind of have to prove themselves on the trail first before they're given the benefit of the doubt that they could be a pretty big challenger. So I do think that you see those pieces, but at the end of the day, it's hard to really suss some of this out, because we don't have as many Republican women running as we do Democratic women running. So I think that you do get a little bit of skewed data. And then the last piece is just to yours, which that we definitely see a lot more comments and questions from the media when it comes to women's appearance. Again, their likability level. And then always the question, if they have family, it's like, who's watching the kids? Right? Like, it's, you must have a really great support system because that you don't have to be home. I mean, making all of those kind of, anytime you bring that up, A, you're calling out a woman's level of priority with her family, which you wouldn't do with a man. But B, is making that an issue in her credibility or ability to hold the position, rather than focusing just on the issues and fundraising and, you know, all those other kind of pieces that you see with men.
Yeah. And I think for our audience, something to be aware of, especially if you are involved in like state caucuses, is you have to just be aware of that kind of tendency, that bias that you might have and that the media has, not bringing it up or just overlooking the women candidates to a slightly bigger degree, and just taking a step back. Because when that list of recruits or potential recruits comes across your desk, and making sure that you are giving the airtime to women candidates, because especially in those swing seats, if you're a Republican, this is especially true. But there is kind of an additional persuasion demographic that you'll be able to reach with a woman candidate that you might not with a male candidate. And it, for the same reasons that a woman is not seen as tough on those security issues that I mentioned before to a primary electorate on the right, that actually works in her favor in the general election. So, you know, recognizing kind of what those stereotypes mean in a primary, but then also how they can be advantageous in a general, it really needs to have those kind of caucus officials, those teams that are really working on the recruitment and the general consultants on the right and kind of the teams on the left that are going out and finding these candidates to really put that extra effort in to kind of brush up the women candidates and make sure that they are being put in the best possible light to the insiders who are going to help kind of showcase them to the rest of the caucus and to the media.
Yeah. One thing I wanted to add to this really fast minute, because you just made me think of it, is that I also don't see a lot of women consultants being interviewed or brought in as experts in at the same like kind of level or the same amount of time as I see males on the political consulting side, right? So if you have an article where they're looking for kind of getting both sides of the aisle or at least getting Republican or Democrat specifically, I don't feel like I very often see women consultants being asked to weigh in or being given the opportunity to give their expertise as experts in a certain space quite as often as the males. And one of the things that I always find interesting is, again, you see them quoted on the things that are women specific, like on women candidates, they'll try and find like women consultants or if it's on like a particular issue, like they'll ask a woman pollster like, hey, what are you seeing for this particular issue in the polls? But again, just like with women candidates, women work in all different spaces at all different levels, Democrat, Republican, like we have expertise across the board. It doesn't just have to be in those spaces. So I think it's also on the practitioner side that I see not quite as much attention being given to the women experts.
Oh, that's a whole nother podcast for us to talk about. And I know that yeah. It's from talking to friends on the other side of the aisle, it's as much of an issue on the left as it is on the right. Yeah. I think the last question I have on kind of these standards is, you touched on this a little bit in the beginning of our conversation, but do women candidates themselves hold themselves to a higher standard than we've seen some male candidates hold themselves to?
I mean, yes. Again, these are such easy questions. No, I'm just kidding. But yes, one of my most favorite things to bring up is just that, like, how many training organizations exist for women and then like none exist on for men, like, because men don't think they need to be trained. They're good to go. Like, you know, yes, I think there is a difference. I think the thing, though, especially on the training that always makes me laugh is like everyone should be trained. It actually isn't a detriment that women want to know what they're getting involved in and making sure that they feel prepared to be effective. If anything, we should be expecting that men get trained as well as women when it comes to holding office. Don't think it's a bad thing, but I do think it ends up being a little bit of a barrier if a woman feels like she has to know everything or be an expert in everything before she can jump in, because so much of this is going to be learned as you get in, as you go, especially if you're not or have never held office, you're not going to be privy to a lot of the information that you will once you get into office when it comes to making some policy decisions. Really, what you need is to get really clear on your principles, get clear on your why, understand kind of how you're going to make decisions, what's going to drive you. And that should then lead you to being able to make good decisions once you get into office. But you don't have to know every single thing about every single issue. It's just way too much, which is why there's staff. That's why there's, you know, people to be helpful. There's going to be experts you can go to and call third-party entities. Like, there's so many other people in this world, in this political and policy space to help you make decisions that you don't have to know everything. And I think women feel like they kind of need to. So it's like, again, I think it's to our benefit that we want to feel trained and feel like we know what we're doing. But I also don't want it to ever feel like it's a detriment if you don't feel 100% prepared or 100% an expert on things. Because you, again, if you feel like you are the best person for that position, and you want to make your case and sell yourself to the public to be their representative, then you already have kind of that self-possession that you can do it. And you just kind of need to ride that. But again, I think it's more about encouraging women that are thinking of running for office to not let the being a complete expert be the barrier. Then on the flip side, I would recommend that some of the men listening also think through, like, maybe I should also get some knowledge before I jump in. And actually know, and especially know that there's a difference between campaigning and governing. They require different skills, some overlap, but some different, and that it's okay to get a sense, but just don't let it become something that, I hate this phrase, but I'm going to say it. Don't let the perfect be the enemy of the good, especially if you know that you have are pretty clear in your principles and why.
Yeah, I think a lot of the times that need to feel like an expert or at least be aware of a lot of the issues slows women down. And so much of, again, how the caucuses work and how recruitment works is, oh, okay, we checked the box. Someone credible jumped in. We'll stop recruiting now and we'll kind of help clear the way so we don't have a contentious primary. And if women hesitate too long, we've all seen like a really credible woman just wait a month later than, you know, a halfway decent male candidate jumps in, but then she gets brushed aside because it's like, well, he already jumped in. So there's definitely a timing issue that comes into play. And I think just bringing this back to kind of how the other consultants should think about it, my phrase always is, you know, the women candidates will ask all of the questions and then jump in. And the male candidates jump in and then ask all of the questions. For the consultants here, you're spending the same amount of time answering the questions before or after. I know it's harder sometimes to be answering all the questions in what feels like the pitch stage as opposed to once they've signed, but it's the same amount of time that you're spending with this candidate. So I wouldn't let that deter you from going out and seeking the candidates. And that, I think, is segueing into kind of the next part of the conversation that I wanted to have with you, Larissa, is just, you know, we're talking to a lot of political consultants here. You and I talk to candidates all the time, but talking to the consultants, how can the consultants, you know, what benefit is there for them to help create like a pipeline for women candidates and to really bring them into the fold?
So for me, the most obvious, and it's probably going to be the most cynical, but at the end of the day, when you have a broadened base, a ready-to-go pipeline of effective people that are trained and ready and just waiting kind of for the right timing and the right race, you win. I mean, your likelihood of winning is going to go up the more that you can be prepared on the front end for when these seats open, whether it be specials, whether it be just general cycle, open seats, challenged, whatever it may be, it's to everyone's benefit to have more choice and more availability of really good candidates that are ready to go so that you don't have to spend that much time in the like training space once they're signed or helping them feel like they are, you know, the convincing or running the numbers or trying to find. I feel like we were talking the other day about how, you know, there's so many states where the amount of or the lack of challengers for either side in some of these races is kind of mind-boggling when they could be competitive races, could be competitive seats. You could potentially even win them, but you need really good candidates. But the amount of effort it takes every single cycle to try and find those candidates and then get them trained and get them educated and have their support group on board and all these pieces. I mean, wouldn't it be nice if you could say, I have like 20 amazing people that could run, like, let's find the best one for this moment or the, you know, the one that's going to be the most competitive or the couple of them and like really go at this. It just makes for, at least for me, a much more fun consulting period. So I think it's more, I mean, I don't want to be cynical though, but I think it's like, if you really want to have as much runway as possible for the actual fundraising and strategy and the implementation, the execution of that to get to winning, then you need to spend less time on recruiting and training. And the only way to do that is to have a, like, have robust pipelines.
Yeah. I would just, on my side, I would just add that same thing that I said before, like, women ask all the questions and then jump in. And then once they're in, they tend to be all in. So if you can kind of get through and break that bubble and get them to run, you're going to have a very dedicated candidate who can really move the needle.
Yeah. Well, and I do feel like there's this weird kind of, I'm going to say, old viewpoint that women are more of a risk, or that they don't raise as much money, or that they don't win as often. And I think the polls have showed that over the past several cycles, like, that's not necessarily true. They win just as much when they jump in. They raise just as much when they jump in, but they need to feel prepared and confident and ready to go, which is why, again, having pipelines, I mean, WPLN is part of that and the work that we do. And it is a lot of work. I'm not going to lie. It's a lot of work to get there. But women, when they get there, they do raise money. They tend to involve the community. Their approach to leadership, regardless of whether it's a Democrat or Republican, is one of problem solving. They actually want to, you know, really find solutions for their communities, which helps continue to push on the narrative that women are good in leadership positions. I mean, it's a full cycle. And the more women that you have in the pipeline running and winning and leading once they get there, the easier it's going to be to continue to pull them in and continue to see these diverse perspectives at decision-making tables. So to the consultants, yes, there may be a lot at the front end, but the return is still there. Mm-hmm. And if anything, a pipeline allows for more return.
Yeah. And I mean, I'm going to give a little bit more incentive to do this. One of the things that I've noticed is that if a consultant gets a good reputation for being able to work with women candidates, that is known, and then you're sought out by those who are women who are looking to run, maybe not right now, but maybe a couple of years from now. And it does wind up being a little bit of a snowballing kind of effort, which is, you know, good for business. I think if, you know, we've got some other consultant focused pieces here, it's like, and probably just like wrapping up with this, is where do those consultants go to find these women candidates, and where, because clearly, especially on the right, we've looked in kind of the so-called traditional spaces to find women candidates. Where do you recommend consultants kind of go to find women in their communities that could make standout candidates? Because it's not quite the same place where they go for male candidates.
Yeah. Well, one, if you're on the right, feel free to come to WPLN. We have center-right women in our network, and there's obviously a number of organizations that do similar work on the left. So definitely, like, get involved in those organizations, go to their events, their training events, their social events. You're going to find a lot of women that are kind of at least dipping their toe in for that. I think the other piece is looking to professional associations, and I think corporations or companies, it gets a little tricky, but professional associations, you have a lot of women that are already showing that they want to be involved because they've put themselves forward to be a member of an association. They tend to kind of take that brand fairly seriously. They typically know some of the issues already and how it impacts, especially on the economic side, if they're small business owners, realtors, like in those kind of spaces, Farm Bureau, cattlemen, all of those places, you have, I think, women that are already have that authenticity. They just need to kind of move from professional into political. You obviously, there's always kind of the usual of, like, especially if you're doing school board or local, of the PTAs and, you know, junior leagues and kind of those, the other, like, women's social groups. You know, women, I hate to say it, we tend to gather. We tend to have women things that we do and not women things we do, but we tend to like to get involved and be involved in things. So, you know, any kind of community groups, associations, I think are really where you find women that at the very least have shown that they have a comfort with putting themselves forward, with wanting to be involved in their communities. And it's really just making the case for moving to the next level, and like how the political is really just another avenue for them to make community impact. And it's another way for them to, you know, bring change back around even if they don't necessarily like the idea of the political, it's selling them on the position and that the political is just like the necessary piece to get them into the position.
Yeah. Well, I want to say thank you for having this conversation. Like I said, that we've had many times, but this time recorded for the AAPC. And thank you so much.
Yeah, it was great. Great to join. And I hope for all the consultants listening that they, again, find those amazing women candidates, help them and get them into office, both sides.
That was our chat with Amanda Iovino and Larissa Martinez. Don't miss an episode. Subscribe to The Future of Political Consulting by the AAPC on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. And join the conversation by following us on social media at the AAPC. Thanks for listening.